This is Radio Boston. I'm not going to tell you who I am because I have a name with a lot of syllables that says a little something about me. But does my voice? Can you tell what I look like just by listening to me? Well, a new interactive exhibition at the Museum of Science asks the same question. Visitors walk up to a screen that has six faces on it, faces with different skin tones. Out of the monitor comes a voice. You don't know whose. And the challenge is to match the voice to one of the six faces, just by sound alone. Radio Boston's Jason Breslow recently visited the exhibit and caught up with a pair of local students who were giving it a shot.
I usually turn the question around and ask.
So going by the voice that we're hearing, which of these guys do you think matches up with the voice?
I'm going to say the first one.
Why the first one?
Well, he has like a deep voice, and he looks like the guy in the picture looks like he has a deep voice.
You think it might be the one on the far right. Why do you say that?
Because, like, his race of talking, I can, like, hear it, and it looks just like him.
What's his race? He kind of looks, he looks Asian, right? What do you think?
Like, Chinese Asian, like.
Should we press the button that says reveal the speaker and see who it is?
Okay. It was him.
It was him?
It's mine.
So you were right, and you guessed wrong the first time around. Should we try a female one and see how it goes?
Sure.
When I came here, the biggest culture shock for me was people in Jamaica.
How does this voice sound?
Soft. She mentioned that she was Jamaican, so either that one or that one.
The one on the top left, she looks like she has darker skin. And the woman on the bottom right, she looks like she has lighter skin. What made you guess those two?
The voice and, like, how she's speaking of, like, in her nationality in the background, like, her culture.
What made you guess those two?
Well, I guess them two because, like, it's very soothing. They both look like they can, like, have a soothing voice.
Are we ready to figure out who it is?
Yes.
I'm Jamaican.
Oh, we did not guess it.
We did not get it.
Who did it end up being?
The one in the middle of the top row.
And can you describe what she looks like?
She looks like she's, like,
Asian.
Yeah, Asian. And
like black hair.
I would never thought she was from Jamaica.
So if you can't tell race by the sound of someone's voice, are there other ways, maybe other scientific ways? And by the way, what is race, after all? Scientists have been digging into that question for centuries, and it turns out the deeper they dig for biological evidence of racial differences, the more they discover there's nothing there. So, on today's Talker, the intersection of race and science. Is there a basis for race in science? And if not, why do we keep looking for one? What does that say about science? And what does it say about us? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And for those of you who are still dying to know my name, shame on you for not knowing and listening to Radio Boston more often, but I am Meghna Chakrabarty. And what got us thinking about this idea was the new exhibition, Race, Are We So Different? It's up now at the Museum of Science. And one of the people involved in the exhibition is Alan Goodman. He's a professor of biological anthropology at Hampshire College and a former president of the American Anthropological Association. Professor Goodman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's a delight to have you here. So tell us about the origin and the inspiration of this exhibition that's trying to look at the relationship between science and race.
Love to. The exhibit itself is a thoroughly fascinating and eye-opening examination of the idea of race. And it looks at the idea of race, how race came about, through three lenses. The lens of history, or how the idea was invented and eventually made to seem like a reality. Through science, which, as you've alluded to already, has had a really interesting relationship to race. At first, it sort of affirmed that race was much the same as human biological variation and could be used as a way to think about human biological variation. And then later on, as we show in the exhibit, turns around and says that, no, race is not a very good or powerful way to look at human variation. In fact, one could call it a biological myth. And finally, through the lens of lived experience and the diverse impacts that race has on our lives. So even though race doesn't seem like a very useful biological concept, it still is a very powerful idea, a powerful illusion. So the exhibit came about a decade ago. A group of anthropologists led by Yolanda Moses, who's a professor and chancellor at University of California, Riverside, was president of the American Anthropological Association. She and myself and a group of other individuals began to realize that the scientific ideas of race had changed quite a bit, that they'd flipped from being one that would promote race or see race as being real biologically to quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. And we also realized that some of our historical and cultural understandings of race had changed. So we decided to do something rather monumental, which was to mount a public campaign, a public education project to look at race. And we went to the Ford Foundation and to the National Science Foundation, and were able to raise money to put together the public education project. And we eventually were paired with the Science Museum of Minnesota to put together the exhibit that opened in 2007.
Professor Gooden, I'm sorry to interrupt, because you just said so many things that actually really caught my attention. I wonder if we could dig into them a little more, because you talked about how one of the inspirations of this exhibit was the fact that science's view or conception of race has changed so dramatically over the course of decades, centuries, even millennia. I mean, I was doing some homework about this today, and I look back, and it's basically, if you go not even all that far back, just a couple centuries back to Carl Linnaeus, the father of modern scientific taxonomy. He's the one who said we can separate species into different categories. He himself had 5 different taxa for human beings: Americanus, Asiaticus, Africanus, Europeans, and a fictional one, it looks like, named Monstrosus.
Monstrosus.
Monstrosus. Yeah. And that's just one example of several others about how science was really actually looking to drive a wedge between types of people. Are there other examples of how science was really used maybe to in a more negative way in terms of how we view each other racially?
Certainly, there's a lot of negative science in the Americas. For instance, Samuel Morton tried to not only accept that there were 4 or 5 or 6 or 3 different races, but to say that they differed in cranial capacity, and cranial capacity was a measure of intelligence. So not only were there differences, but that we could rank races by intelligence. And that happened in the mid-1800s, as slavery was coming about.
And he was measuring actually the circumference of skulls.
Well, actually, correct? What he was doing was a little bit more interesting. It was actually taking skulls and putting seeds into skulls to actually measure the volume of different skulls. Mm. But we now know that the volume of a skull doesn't have anything to do with one's intelligence.
You know, and I understand that a lot of people who turn to quote-unquote scientific reasons for racial differences, they like to look back to Darwin himself. However, Darwin in The Descent of Man in 1871 basically says he doesn't see any scientific basis for saying that there are different races in human beings at all.
That's correct. And actually, what's even, I think, more interesting to me is that the whole idea of evolution is antithetical to the idea of race. That race is an idea about typologies that are stable, that don't change through time.
Whoops. Looks like
once you have a race, it stays stable. And Darwin was all about change through time.
Mm. And so if I just the timeline of science's fraught relationship with race is so fascinating. If I can fast forward just a little bit, we see science being used to justify apartheid in South Africa. Fast forward even more, obviously, there's the eugenics movements, Nazism. 1994, people might remember that infamous book, The Bell Curve, coming out in the late 20th century, saying, yes, we can actually measure through statistical evidence differences in intelligences between races.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what the American Anthropological Association was responding to, is that in psychology and in other realms of science, they hadn't quite come around to the idea that race is such an ephemeral biological idea, that it was really environment that is important, and that there is variation among us, but it's geographic. It's location, location, location. And that, so for instance, the amount of genetic difference between one African and another is actually surprisingly greater than the amount of genetic difference between the average African and the average European or Asian. So there, as you kind of said, there's no there when to the idea of race as a biological entity.
And yet what I find so ironic is that there's this lure to keep looking to science to find the there that's there, even though it's not. And it comes from surprising places. I read that just as recently as 2007, James Watson, you know, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, I mean, he's quoted in 2007 saying that he has, quote, he's inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa because all our social policies are based on the fact that there, the Africans' intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. So we haven't yet mostly, but not completely stepped away from a scientific basis of racial inequity.
Yeah, I think James Watson is a brilliant man, obviously, but he's not a sociologist, he's not a historian, he doesn't understand criminality and so the factors that go into it. So I think he did what a lot of people do, which is they look at a correlation and they think it's causal. And you know, just because there's increased rates of crime in a particular area certainly doesn't mean that it's due to any inherent biological differences amongst people.
Mm. Well, there's a lot to talk about in terms of how we see science and race, and I want to do that by introducing another guest. Alondra Nelson is an associate professor of sociology at Columbia University. She's currently a visiting fellow at the Max Planck Institute for History of Science in Berlin, where she joins us now. Professor Nelson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
So you have looked into this question about how race has been studied in science in many different ways, from basically how doctors diagnose and treat African-American patients to the Human Genome Project, which is very interesting in this topic.
Yes.
So let's start there. In 2000, you noted that President Bill Clinton said that the Human Genome Project showed, quote, our common humanity, but that focus on the commonalities between people hasn't continued in terms of genomics.
Yes, it's been an interesting moment, but I think, you know, what I want us to sort of end the conversation with is also thinking that it's a new opportunity. So it's an occasion, I think, for us to think in new ways about race and science. But yes, there's this incredible moment where we use all of this technology and all of this genius to decode the human genome and to really sort of codify in important ways the fact that we're 99.9% alike as a human species, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, those tools bring with it the possibility of parsing in new ways the 0.1% in which, you know, individuals and populations might vary. And so, you know, one of the things I would want people to take away is to think about that decision as a choice that societies and communities make, right? I mean, we make a choice to look at the 0.1% rather than the 99.9%. You know, there could be some arguments that will remain to be seen about whether or not that 0.1% is where, you know, medical utility might lie, and it might be practical to do so. But it's just a general kind of broader issue. The fact that we concentrate on the 0.1%, I think, should be noted as a choice that we make. And there are other societies where, you know, people are struggling to get immunization, to get access to, you know, antiviral medications and the like, where, you know, the 99.9% is a lot more important.
And so why is it that you think that, you know, we as people and also, I guess, scientists still want to look at that 0.1% of genetic difference and see what's there?
Yeah, well, it's partly, you know, the conversation that you and Professor Goodman were having already about the history of scientific racism, about the ways in which we've historically created typology. So, you know, I think there's a way in which there's been a framework created around how we understand, in particular, Western societies and very much American society, meaning the U.S. in this instance, in which this is a society founded on slavery, founded on difference and about using physical characteristics to sustain social and economic differences. difference in the society. So partly, we, you know, there's one, on the one hand, we might not expect anything else but that to be the case. On the other hand, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the choice of a society that comes out of that history, the choices we make as scientists and as social scientists, and also about just the privilege of being able to do so, to have the money and the technology to you know, rather than focusing our attention solely on fundamental things like, you know, as I said, like access to immunizations and the like, to focus on these smaller things. So, you know, I think we have the privilege and the luxury and the technology and the you know, the money to focus, to scrutinize the one-tenth percent.
Well, oh, I want to bring in the voice of our callers here, because listeners, we are talking about the intersection of science and race, and the history shows how people like scientists, politicians, and even just regular people keep trying to intertwine race and biology like a string of DNA. But when science actually looks as close as it has, science says there's no such thing really as race. So what do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shefali is calling from Somerville. Welcome to Radio Boston, Shefali.
Hi there.
What's your thought? Hi there.
So I think this conversation is fascinating from the lens of someone I've studied race from a demographic perspective in my public policy program, and I wonder if it's not so much more complicated than scientists are human beings, and from a social framework, and I don't limit this to just the United States, but Western societies, Eastern societies, there are all kinds of racial characterizations that people tend to make, and I wonder if that tendency that we have is somehow the thing that ought to be studied, and what your thoughts are about that.
It's a great question, Shefali. Let me turn it to Alan Goodman, professor of biological anthropology at Hampshire College. Professor Goodman, what do you make of that?
Yeah, it is a great question, and to add on to something, that 0.1%. Race doesn't even explain that, so that's explained by history and evolution. And so it is interesting why we keep grappling onto it, and I think part of it is that, you know, we like to categorize. We're a species that does it. But I think it is also a little bit deeper than that, and it is about systems of power and inequality, and it's hard to give up on those things sometimes. And so there are racial differences in wealth and health, and I think that, you know, we desperately want to explain those by, you know, due to something other than human institutions and the history of differential treatment, and that, you know, really takes a very powerful eye to look at. And so I think that that's been part of the human tendency as well. And, you know, part of the field that Dr. Nelson is part of is really looking at the tendencies of science and how they're influenced by social institutions. And science is one of the most social and political events and processes that one can think of.
Mm. Professor Nelson, your response to that?
Yeah, I think I would just want to thank Shefali for bringing this point up. I mean, I think that we, to our peril, you know, we tend to think of science as being a domain that's separate from the social world. And precisely as she says, you know, scientists are human actors. Social scientists, who I think are also, you know, sociologists, and she mentioned demographers, we can be equally guilty of using race in ways that's not complex at all. And when we talk about variables, even when we're looking at inequality. And so, you know, hopefully that the part of what this conversation and the conversation that this exhibition will elicit is this sort of sense that, you know, that science isn't a sphere of that's sort of sealed off from the rest of the social world, right? That we bring to the questions we pose in science all of this sort of history, all of our social orientations, the questions that we're curious about in our own societies are posed, you know, on the bench in the laboratory often.
Let's get another call in here. Mike is calling from Milford. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mike.
Hi, thank you. I had a question. Race seems to be uniquely human. We don't apply the word race to any other animals. We don't have different races of, say, apes or parrots. And so if we classify humans as different species and apply that same scientific principle, like what actually classifies one ape to a different species, apply that to humans, and we may find there is none, or we are. you know, what is that definition of species versus race?
Mike, thank you so much for your call. Professor Goodman.
Well, there is a concept of subspecies that zoologists use, but that in and of itself has become a little bit problematical and under attack, primarily because it's frequently hard to draw the line between where one subspecies begins and another subspecies ends. And the idea of race, as you said, was sort of totally invented for use in humans, but at one point was thought to be somewhat comparable to subspecies. And to say part of the problem of that, even with humans, is that humans, unlike, say, kind of geographically bound subspecies, tend to move around and mate and migrate and all sorts of things. So in some sense, we're one great big breeding population, and so there's, you know, any idea of bounding human variation is extremely fraught and extremely difficult.
There's a great deal of fluidity. Professor Alondra Nelson, let me ask you, we had been talking about how science is not an island that's immune from social pressures.
Sure.
And our cultural and historical moment. One really fascinating thing to me is that we're currently in a technological and cultural moment where people can take a cheek swab, send it off to a lab, and find out what their ancestry is. And there's a great deal of interest in that. So,
yes. So
how is it that you see that, like, this pressure of using DNA technology to find out what our ancestry is, how is that playing into people's conception of what science can tell us about where we're from?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting way of thinking about this, because this is where these ideas about the association or not between race and science sort of operate on the ground. One of the things that's so interesting, what I've been working with people who use genetic genealogy testing and sort of tracking the emergence of it here in the U.S., and going into the research, I thought that people were going to be saying to me after getting their tests, well, I've had this test and it tells me that I'm X and Y and thus I am X and Y. And in fact, there's a lot of sort of sophistication and nuance and negotiation on the ground when people get these tests, right? That actually, you know, in a way gives the lie to even, you know, sometimes social scientists will say, well, there's a common sense idea of race, and often that's a mistaken biological one. But looking at the ancestry testing, you find out how sophisticated people are in thinking about these things. And If it doesn't fit with how they understand the social world, you know, the test just sort of, you know, goes in a shelf somewhere in the house, the test results. It's not a kind of wholesale transformation of identity. And so I think that's one way that we can sort of think about the sort of dynamism of not only of race, right, mm-hmm. over time and even in this moment, but the sort of dynamism of race at the conjunction of science, and in this case, genetic ancestry testing.
Professor Goodman, if I could just throw the last question to you, we've just got a couple seconds here. Does what Professor Nelson is what she's saying, does it make you think that no matter how much science says we're all the same, that we're all that we as people will continuously look for those differences?
Well, I think we will look for both. We will look for differences, but the problem for me, and I think what this is coming towards, is that those differences are much, much more complicated than simply putting individuals in three or four or five different boxes. That we're all very complex with complex histories and migrations and things of that sort. And I think that's what's interesting is I think we can put the genetics into that complex history.
Well, Professor Alan Goodman, he's a professor, I should say, of biological anthropology at Hampshire College and former president of the American Anthropological Association. He's joining us from the studios of WFCR in Amherst. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you so much.
And Alondra Nelson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Columbia University and a visiting fellow at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin. Professor Nelson, pleasure to have you on Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Magna.
And the exhibition Race, Are We So Different? Is at the Boston Museum of Science through May 15th.